I hate to interrupt the dance party. Linoleum knife.
You know, I just wanted the kids to know that they didn't invent twerking. It's been around.
Since the butt.
Yes. From the soundtrack of School Days.
Yes.
So next time you twerk, thanks Spike Lee.
Yes. All right. This is Linoleum Knife. I'm Dave White. And this is almost the last you're going to hear of me for the rest of this episode.
Whew. Everybody got scared there for a second.
I'm an invalid today, and I'm not able to have a conversation for a full hour plus that won't involve sneezing, blowing my nose, coughing, and coughing, and coughing.
You'll be doing all that in the background.
I'll be doing all that in the background. We've called in my doppelganger.
Your evil twin.
We both have facial hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much all it takes. Okay. Every time I get a photo from somebody, oh my God, I saw your twin. It's, oh, a fat guy with a beard and glasses. Yes, I can see the resemblance.
All right, I'm going to go sit down on the couch now.
Okay.
With my laptop and a hot water bottle on my chest to clear up all this crud inside of me.
There's some VapoRub in the medicine
cabinet. I'll do that later.
Okay.
On my laptop, I'm going to study James Dean's pre-Canyons body of work.
Mm-hmm. And his pre-Canyons body, I assume.
Maybe.
Okay.
Actually, I'll be on eBay looking up vintage Christmas ornaments.
You're so less racy than you want people to think. Why don't you tell people who's going to be filling in for you today, Dave White?
Why don't we let him introduce himself?
Go ahead.
I'd like to, but I don't have the mic.
Oh, well, hello. My name is William Bibbiani. I am the host of the B-Movies podcast.
Oh, you're NPRing.
Yeah. We had to record an episode of the B-Movies podcast a couple of weeks ago, but at like 3 a.m. while someone was asleep in the other room, so we kept it really mellow. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm the film channel editor at Crave Online. I also co-host the B-Movies podcast, and I am very thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, Venus Flytrap. And I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film critic for TheWrap.com and What the Flick, a weekly program on YouTube. And before I forget, my co-host on that show, or co-presenter, or co-something on that show, Miss Christy Lemire, is the special guest of this week's B-Movies podcast.
That's
and
right.
She has just launched ChristyLemire.com. ChristyLemire.com, which is her new base of operations, because she has untethered herself from AP, so now she's freelancing and doing other stuff, and so check her site out.
I like the idea of calling it a base of operations. It sounds like she has a Christy Lemire cave
exactly
somewhere, and giant computers filled with lights that blink out of sequence.
Make them blink in sequence. Okay.
And also, so, Alonzo, if the viewers at home, I always regret that the Linoleum Knife have been able to see
no one's actually viewing.
Yeah, like I really feel like this should be a video podcast because Alonzo just danced to the School Days soundtrack for like a minute and a half in a Yo Gabba Gabba shirt. And he was really grooving on it, and it was totally awesome. It's one of my favorite things I've seen this week.
Without ever leaving my chair, so yeah.
Well, you know, real dancing isn't restricted to the floor.
No, by no means.
Yes.
No, the Terpsichorean muse will touch upon you wherever you are.
Wow, Terpsichorean. Wow.
That's how we roll here.
Some pretentious word.
Look, if you haven't seen Xanadu, it's not my fault.
I actually haven't seen Xanadu.
I've been what?
You know, I've been waiting to go to a screening, like a proper screening of it.
Okay.
Like, you know, like you haven't seen Barry Lyndon, and I'm always on
true,
you for this.
Yes.
And you keep saying, I'm waiting to see it on the big screen.
Yeah,
and
I don't know that I would put Xanadu in that category, but
okay.
I understand the mentality behind
okay,
it.
Okay, fair enough. What are we going to be doing on this week's Linoleum Knife?
Yeah, so your show is very good about announcing up front what people are about to get, and we just sort of throw it at them. But in your honor, this week we are reviewing the action comedy Two Guns, the family flick, The Smurfs 2, coming-of-age drama, The Spectacular Now, the
whatever it is, the passion.
The Canyons.
The Canyons,
and the whatever it is passion.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of that this week.
Yeah.
It's funny. When we talked about the Canyons on What the Flick, you know, Christy was like, well, it's supposed to be an erotic thriller, and I didn't find it to be thrilling or erotic. And I said, well, it's I don't think that it's supposed to be an erotic thriller.
I'm in a weird position on the Canyons because I agree with both you and Christy.
Oh, do so.
Are we just going to get into this right now?
We'll do a quick précis of what this is. The Canyons, you've probably heard about, is Lindsay Lohan's latest film. She co-stars with adult film star James Dean.
That's Dean with two E's.
Correct.
Yes.
And it is a collaboration between screenwriter Bret Easton Ellis, the guy who wrote Lesson Zero and American Psycho, among others, and director Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver, wrote and directed American Gigolo. He
did Hardcore.
Hardcore, Autofocus.
Yeah.
You know, he's actually
pretty good.
He's great. No, no. In fact,
Everyone involved in the project has actually, like, been really, really good in other stuff.
Yeah. And in fact, my first year when I was programmer at the USA Film Festival Dallas, we honored Schrader. You know, this was in 95.
As opposed to, like, you know, we honored Paul Schrader and then we dishonored someone else.
That's right.
We had Paul W.S. Anderson on here and we just brought him on stage and made fun of him.
Weird story. Ooh. Paul W.S. Anderson was at that festival with the movie Shopping.
Oh, and that's like the good one.
Yes.
Okay.
So, this was fresh from Sundance, mm-hmm. Paul W.S. Anderson, not mm-hmm. hacky adapter of video games, Paul W.S. Yes. Anderson. That would come later.
Yeah.
But anyway, no, so Schrader was great. And he is, you know, he started out as a film critic, you know, like a lot of the French New Wavers. So he is, a friend of mine was asking me, oh, should I go to this screening of The Canyons Monday night at you know, the Hammer or something, and I said yes. I said, even if you hate the movie, Schrader is going to be because he's going to be there.
Yeah,
so Schrader will be fascinating to listen to talk about it, even if you don't like the movie. You know,
yeah, and there's a really good chance you won't like the movie.
It seems to be that way. I'm definitely in the minority on Rotten Tomatoes, but it's basically Dean and Lohan play a Hollywood not power couple. He is a Trustafarian who is basically producing movies.
Is that a real word?
I've heard it.
Okay.
About it. I like it.
Trust fund baby.
Yeah.
Just kind of safarian through life kind of deal.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, so he's producing movies only because he has to prove to his dad that he's doing something with his life.
Yeah.
But basically, he is something of a sociopath and.
Because he's a Bretta Easton Ellis character.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's his shtick.
And so the crux of their relationship seems to be him finding sexy strangers on his iPhone and having them come over and either watching them or participating in the two of them having sex.
Indeed.
Which we
get to see.
Which we get to
it's
see.
It's very, very nice, actually. I enjoyed that aspect of the film.
This actor named Ryan gets cast as the lead in a horror film that the James Dean's character is producing.
Yeah.
It turns out that he and the Lohan character have a past. And possibly a present.
But will they have a future?
There you go.
Yes.
And so the movie is very, you know, it is what you would expect, I think, from a Schrader-Ellis collaboration, in that it is oblique and it is chilly and it is nihilistic. And it operates in a world that, you know, we are inclined to think of as glitzy and glamorous, but shows it to be sort of empty and hollow and soul draining.
Yes, that's very much true.
Yeah.
I wrote in my review that I think it's difficult to argue that The Canyons isn't a work of artistic vision. Mm. I just don't think it envisions anything of interest.
Mm.
I think you look at this movie, and again, Paul Schrader knows what he's doing. Bret Easton Ellis knows how to write. Mm. Lindsay Lohan actually knows how to act. She doesn't always do it, but when she does, she's quite good.
Yeah, she's not the Lindsay Lohan of yore, and we may never see that Lindsay Lohan again.
That's probably fair.
When I was reviewing it, I was saying that Schrader cast the two right people.
Sure.
Whether or not they're doing, whether or not they know what they're doing necessarily, or they just have been, they're just perfect for these roles, it's hard to say. But I think that, but what I told Christy though is that at the same time, you could cast a dozen other people and ask them to do what these two are doing and they would do it wrong.
That's true. No, that's very, very true. No, again, I think Lindsay Lohan does her job very, very well here. Mm. I think James Dean does his job very, very well here. I think this movie is very clearly what at least Paul Schrader intended it to be. I read some interview with Bret Easton Ellis where he said he kind of thought it was going to be a bit more broad genre-like, I think he envisioned it as more of
like a noir or something.
Maybe
or?
Not a noir. I don't know. I got the impression he envisioned it a little bit more like Rules of Attraction. Yeah. I think he envisioned something a little bit more like that, a little bit more
like
punchy.
The book or the movie.
Get the impression of the movie, but that's me putting words in his mouth. That's just the impression I got.
I'll look it up.
But he said that's not really what he envisioned the movie to be. But regardless, it feels like Paul Schrader wanted to make this movie. I just didn't want to see this movie.
Hmm.
And that's normally I don't like reviewing a film and saying, oh, it's not the movie I wanted to see, because the movie we get is what matters.
Sure, yeah.
And even if you have an initial reaction that's like, oh, I didn't expect that, well, you don't get to mark it down for that. That's not your fault. That's not your movie's fault. That's your fault.
Right.
But I feel like I see what this movie is doing. It is telling a story of very shallow, self-involved, vindictive, manipulative people who aren't very aware of themselves or their emotions.
Sure.
And that's totally what it's about, and it captures that very, very well. I just... it doesn't dramatize it very well. Mm. The story was not interesting enough for me to really give this movie a positive recommendation, even just because I didn't really care what happened next. I liked the characters, and I was interested in the characters, but what they did disinterested me.
I did care, not in the sense that I cared about any of them and I wanted things to turn out okay for them, but I did care where they were going to go.
You were invested.
I was invested. I felt like I was interested in watching them go down their respective sort of rabbit holes of awfulness, basically.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, for me, on that level, it totally worked. I liked it way more than I liked The Bling Ring, which I think is a...
I still haven't seen The Bling Ring, so I cannot make that comparison. Okay. I will say this. I did think... first off, I will say that James Dean... I think he has the character that I think everyone's most interested in this movie. While they were making it, he gets the most interesting sort of lines and sort of actions, and he gets the most impact on the plot as a sort of sadistic, manipulative person. But I thought it was actually the most interesting character in that at the beginning he says he's very clearly like divorcing emotion from sexuality and in an emotional relationship with Tara, played by Lindsay Lohan. But sex can be completely separate from that, and every time we see like a sexual encounter with him, we see hints that he's not actually doing that successfully.
Sure.
That he has, like, you know, if there's another guy in the room while he's having sex with Tara, they are it's a power thing. Mm-hmm. Or if he's having sex with someone else and she tries to make it more emotional, he can't do that because he's with this other woman. Or there's one it's the one part of the film that feels like it was actually lit. This is a very kind of drab looking movie, and I think that's intentional, but you know, it is. There's this one four-way sequence with them and another couple.
And the crazy light show in the crazy bedroom.
Yeah, it's like they got some kind of cheap, you know, little...
Some sort of disco ball.
Disco ball thing, from like Oz in Westwood, you know? Like the cheap one you get for your college dorm room.
The Spencer Gifts one.
Yeah. Exactly. And it becomes this thing, and he ends up having like a sexual encounter with like another guy. He actually like... He's pushing the two girls, like, yeah, kiss each other.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, that's what I want to see. And then they do that to him, and he goes with it, and then like the next day he's talking to a psychologist played weirdly by
Gus.
Like Gus Van Sant.
Why
not? And someone pointed out that it might even have been Christie, where it was just like, I wish I could have seen Gus Van Sant's version of this movie. That probably would have been better. But he's pointing out that like that made him really uncomfortable. And it was interesting to me was that he was capable of coming to that realization that, you know, the tide had turned here and maybe being a little hypocritical, but he is not capable of the kind of self-introspection or inspection or whatever to do anything with that other than being sadistic and cruel. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that character was really interesting. I thought James Dean, who actually is like a pretty good actor in his pornographic films, is pretty good in it. But again, a lot of it's just like the characters are interesting, but the dialogue is flat. And
right, but
the
I think
flat
that's,
people,
but
like,
that's a Brett Easton Ellis thing. I mean, he creates these characters who do interesting things, but who always generally speak in a rather vapid way.
Right, and I feel like Paul Schrader emphasized the vapidity, which again highlights the characters and the themes and makes what The Canyons is about really, really clear. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it does the movie itself any favors because it didn't make it any more watchable. It actually made it harder to get into. And it's difficult to tell sometimes when someone is giving a terrible performance or when someone is just playing like a terribly boring... Like Nolan Funk, which by the way... There's a porn star in... There's actually more than one porn star in this movie, but there's a porn star starring in this movie, and the one who isn't a porn star is named Nolan Funk, and I love that. Like, I can't tell if he's genuinely terrible or just terribly genuine.
Well,
I can't,
you
know,
it's funny, because I actually made that point in my review talking about Dean. Like, there's a difference between playing a character who is blank and cut off from his emotions and giving a performance that is blank and cut off from emotions. And I think that, for the most part, I mean, certainly I think Dean and Lohan both achieve it, and Funk doesn't do it so badly that it stood out for me. Like, I thought it was okay. I was willing to go with it in the context of this film and the sort of the monotony that this film is trying to achieve.
Right.
I mean, Dean, I have not seen his earlier work. I would say I would be curious to see what he's like in another film that doesn't require him to be cut off from his emotions, because that's kind of what we expect porn stars to do anyway. It's sort of like
I've read that a lot in like a lot of people's reviews, where it's just like, yeah, of course he's a porn star. He's playing someone who has emotionless sex, and I'm like, I met a few porn stars. I've interviewed a lot of porn stars. I'm actually friends with a few, and that's not actually in any way true. And the sort of like, yeah, this is what porn stars are like. He was well cast. Like, not a single one I've ever met.
Well,
interesting.
What
to
I'm
me,
saying is,
are, I'm not saying you're saying that. I'm actually bringing this out just because.
Sure.
I'm
no. I get your
reading.
I agree with you, and I get your point. But what I am saying is that I can't evaluate him as a non-porn actor.
Sure.
Until I see him do a role that actually calls for a level of emotional investment. He does have camera presence.
He does.
Spades.
He's good.
I'll certainly give you that.
He's a good-looking kid.
It's the same with Sasha Grey. Girlfriend experience. Mm-hmm. Like I thought she was perfect for that role. I withhold judgment on her as an actress until I see her in other stuff.
She was good in Would You Rather, a little horror movie that came out earlier this year with her and Jeffrey Combs.
If
you haven't seen that, it's fun. It's a good little flick.
Okay.
Where was I going with this? James Dean. We were talking Nolan Funk. Oh, Nolan Funk. So the thing about Nolan Funk, though, is I got the impression, because he's really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a good-looking kid. And he's given this such a kind of... His character is required to do emotional things and to have emotional outbursts and to kind of be vulnerable and messed with. And I really don't feel like he conveys it terribly well. But a part of me feels like he's playing a character in this movie.
Who's a bad actor.
Who's a bad actor and who's only starring in this movie within a movie that James Dean's character, Christian, is producing because he's like his assistant's girlfriend.
Right.
And a part of me is like, and I think I even wrote this in my review as well, I feel like The Canyons is the kind of movie the characters in The Canyons would make about themselves. And he's the guy who's cast because he slept with the director. You know?
Yeah,
like, that's what it comes across
to me. I don't think the characters in The Canyons are self-aware enough to make The Canyons.
No, and that's the thing. I don't think the movie has its own sense of self-awareness. I think the movie plays so straight, and a lot of the self-awareness, we are projecting onto it because we can see these people in a more interesting light than I think they can see themselves.
Right, which is why they would be incapable of making that.
I know, and then they give it to Paul Schrader, and then Paul Schrader did something. I just feel like... The Canyons, I think we were all kind of expecting either like a total camp train wreck of a, you know, it's going to be the next Apple or Tyler Perry's Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor, something. And it's, or we were going to expect like, you know, maybe everyone was wrong and it's actually a work of unparalleled genius. And I don't think it's interesting enough to be either of those things.
I don't know
whether you care for it or don't.
Yeah,
I don't think it's worth the effort.
I don't know that it's either of those things, but I think it's an interesting film. I think it's an interesting entry in the sort of CV of two artists that I like a lot, Schrader and Ellis. And I think it'll be interesting to see how time treats this movie when the idea of what's Lindsay Lohan doing next becomes less interesting, and when we can sort of look at it on its own merits.
I think that's true for almost any movie that comes with baggage in tow.
Sure,
There's a lot of movies out there, and I've actually been trying to be very aware of this. That this might actually be a better movie than I think, and just because I'm sick of this actor, like Scott Pilgrim versus the World is a good example. We talked about that when you were on our show for the 10 best films of the decade so far, and Scott Pilgrim versus the World didn't do very well. And one of the things I heard from a lot of people was like, "Oh, I'm sick of Michael Cera playing Michael Cera," or whatever our perception of what Michael Cera is.
Right.
And I'm like, that's not the movie's fault. This could be a good movie with that Michael Cera, and you're marking it down because you're experiencing a little bit of fatigue. Mm-hmm. If this had come out like 2 years after the Michael Cera boom, you would just simply appreciate this movie for what it is, whether you like it or not, but that would not be a factor. Or Terrence Malick's To the Wonder, which came out so soon after Tree of Life that I think any positive qualities it has are being kind of dwarfed by, but we saw him do this slightly better in Tree of Life.
Right. Context is everything. I mean, I just got my Ishtar Blu-ray,
which
comes out this week.
Has time been kind? Have you watched it yet?
I have not watched the Blu-ray yet, but I saw it a couple years ago at the New Beverly. In fact, for a long time, the icon of this show, when you would get it, pull it up on iTunes or whatever, was the marquee of the New Beverly, and it was Ishtar, Joe versus Volcano. And I think that time has been kind to Ishtar. I think if you can divorce it from all the pre-release hype and all the pre-release doomsaying and all of the, oh my god, it's such a turkey, it's such a money loser, when it came out, it's actually a funny movie.
That's how I feel about Hudson Hawk.
I love Hudson Hawk.
Hudson Hawk is so ahead of... If you haven't seen Hudson Hawk since it came out, or since you were a kid or something, watch Hudson Hawk. Hudson Hawk feels prescient. Hudson Hawk feels like it takes place in this kind of movie universe.
Yeah.
That is so full of life and so energized. It's, and it doesn't always work, but when it's fascinating, it's... That's right. It's always fascinating.
No, it's kind of weirdly postmodern, but at the same time, it really kind of harkens back to those sort of all-star, globe-trotting 1960s kind of movies, right. You know?
Well, I saw it as a double feature at the New Beverly like last year with To Catch a Thief.
Yes, yeah.
And it was great.
Yeah, no, I've always defended that movie. Dan Waters, I've gotten to know sort of because we've been on a couple of Spirit Award, juries together, and I'm always like, by the way, have I mentioned to you lately how much I love Hudson Hawk? Like, I never even talked to him about Heathers. I just talked to him about Hudson Hawk.
Well, I find that whenever you meet, like, someone who makes a lot of movies or has been in a lot of movies, if you...
Yeah, bring up the unloved
bring
one.
Up, I ran into Sean Astin at Comic-Con this year, and I was just like, dude, Harrison Bergeron was awesome. And it was great. We had, like, a 10-minute conversation about how cool Kurt Vonnegut was, like, during that movie. And I'm like, that's awesome. That's
really fun. Love Harrison Bergeron.
That's a good flick. That's not my DVD recommendation.
No, it's funny. There are some great Vonnegut adaptations and some terrible ones.
Yeah, Slaughterhouse-Five is surprisingly a good movie. I don't know. How do they do that? That's, like, a really tough thing to adapt.
Well, I've probably mentioned this on the show before. My sort of... The American auteur who I think gets so underrated because he spent his later years sick with Parkinson's, he didn't make appearances, he didn't get honored at festivals, and so people don't really acknowledge him as the genius that he was George Roy Hill.
Yeah, he was great.
That's a really hard adaptation to pull off. And not only that he did it so well, but this is a guy whose career spanned everything from Thoroughly Modern Millie to Slapshot.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like Howard Hawks, and you could just plug him into any genre, and he's amazing.
Yeah, and it's not like he's like... His work is unappreciated in any of those genres. Just, like every movie he's done, there's like it has its fans.
Yeah, but just nobody ever ties them together as this guy.
This guy's a great genre director.
People love The Sting. People love Butch Cassidy. People love Slapshot. People love A Little Romance.
Yeah,
But they never, World of Henry Orient. All these amazing films. But you never hear people talk about, wow, George Roy Hill was this great American filmmaker.
I feel like that's true for like way too many people who have a consistently impressive body of work, and yet no one seems to. Maybe they don't have enough of a distinctive artistic stamp.
Sure.
For people to really notice, or even when they do, like for whatever reason, Woody Allen is considered one of the great screenwriters. He's not considered one of the great directors. And I think a lot of it's just because he's made so many movies that it feels like the ratio is off. But I think Woody Allen said, I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality through not dying.
Right.
But when that probably doesn't come to pass, I think, we're going to reach a point where people are like, he made like a dozen classic movies his career. It's insane.
I think he gets his due as a director. Yeah. I think what it is more is for filmmakers like Hill who don't make it easy to connect the dots.
Sure.
If you are a Hitchcock...
He adapted to whatever he was working
with. Right, exactly. Yeah. If you're like a Hitchcock fanatic or, Tarantino or John Ford or, Bergman, Antonioni, there's a lot of, filmmakers where you can sort of see themes and, visual... choices or whatever that kind of run through the work, and it makes it very easy to write that thesis.
Sure.
But then you've got somebody like Hill or like I said, Howard Hawks, who doesn't...
Don Siegel's another one.
Don Siegel, sure, who doesn't have like a signature style, but just delivers, So anyway, one last thing about Vonnegut, and then I'll shut up. If you've never seen it, Jonathan Demme did an adaptation of Who Am I This Time? It's one of the short stories for American Playhouse with Susan Sarandon and Christopher Walken. It's extraordinary.
That sounds good. Is that available on home video?
I think it is. I'll look for it and I'll put a link on our Facebook page. It's amazing.
Cool.
Anyway, moving on. Number one movie this weekend was Two Guns.
Ah, yes. Or not Two Guns.
There you go. That is the question.
I'm a writer.
Or as I said, if you're dyslexic, it's Two News.
Two Gnews.
Or Two Snug. Yes. Anyway, so
we made the Two Gnews joke on our podcast as well. So you and I.
Scary. Okay, so it's Mark Wahlberg's reunion with director Baltazar Kormákur, who did Contraband.
Which was not very good.
Previously did an Icelandic film called 101 Reykjavik. That was sort of his big international breakthrough.
And he actually made quite a few films in Iceland before he made it over here. I haven't seen a single one of them, so my context here might be a little
different. Yeah, all I've seen is Contraband as well.
Okay.
Although I've heard 101 Reykjavik is supposed to be pretty good.
As have I.
So anyway, what?
It's okay.
Dave White says it's okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that would still make it better than Contraband. Two Guns. It's Wahlberg and it's Denzel Washington and We meet them as they are getting ready to rob a bank, and then as we go along, we find out that neither of them is who we think they are or who each other thinks they are. Yes. And suddenly they are both on the run from the DEA and the Navy and the CIA. And
I like just throwing the Navy in there. Yeah. That just seems kind of random. Yeah, the gimmick and
the wackiest ship in the Navy.
The gimmick and the two guns, and it's in the trailer, so I don't think it's a spoiler. Although I actually didn't know it going in because I don't usually watch the trailers. But both Denzel Washington and Mark Wahlberg are undercover,
right?
But neither of them knows the other one is undercover, and they're both planning to screw each other over.
Right.
Which is, that's funny, actually. That's kind of a neat idea.
It's a cool premise.
It's a cool premise. It's something that could probably only happen at a movie. But once you accept that that's kind of contrived and that the entire movie is going to be a little contrived, I think this is actually like a reasonably fun run and gun, perhaps overly violent caper comedy, which, you know, Mark Wahlberg and Denzel Washington are fun. Most of the rest of the supporting cast, like Edward James Olmos, is having a good time which is nice to see him in a movie again.
Yeah, but although I have to say, I don't want to hear him complaining about Latino stereotyping if he's going to play Mexican drug lords.
Well, no, that's the irony, man. Don't you get it? It's like the beginning of Crash when, like, was it Omar Epps and someone else? I'm trying to remember who the
Ludacris.
Yeah, it's like, and they're just like walking down Westwood talking about that. Like, yeah, everyone thinks we're thieves because we're black people. Why is that? Well, it's because we're thieves. And I'm like, that's not a potent message you're making. That's just you fulfilling your own racist prophecy. I don't like that movie. Two Guns, the thing is, Two Guns has a very broad sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And then occasionally it'll whip itself around and try to take death seriously. It's kind of an inconsistent, yeah, weird movie.
My problem with the movie is, you know, I think that you can certainly be funny and be violent at the same time.
Sure.
And a lot of, you know, Shane Black and Tarantino and a lot of people have pulled that off. And you know, there's a way to do it right. This movie does not do it that way. This movie makes the violence so intense and so ouchy, you know, for lack of a better word. You know what I mean?
I want to see that on the DVD. The violence is ouchy.
You know, where it's one thing if you, like, you know, you shoot a guy and he falls over dead or whatever. But when you close up shoot somebody in the kneecap while you're torturing them,
I stop
laughing.
Maybe it's a generational thing, because I grew up like with like the post Tarantino generation. Uh-huh. I was a little bit younger when that was happening, and so maybe I'm a little more immune to this kind of unnecessary ultra violent humor.
Mm-hmm.
What was that, Dave? Dave's mean it too.
That's because Dave is soulless.
Dave is soulless. I am soulless. That's
Dave's a sadist who loves death and violence.
No, I was able to get into like the tone of Two Guns. I kind of liked a film that felt kind of irresponsible. And there was something about that that made it feel like a little rebellious and extra ridiculous. And I never felt that the film was being cruel to the audience. I just thought it existed in a world in which cruelty had a bit more slapstick and a little more comic timing to it. For me, the problem with the movie is it just doesn't feel like you've done anything with your time. It's like, it's watchable, it's entertaining enough. If you wanted to rent this, by all means, fine. But like, you're not going to... It's a movie I'm going to forget about.
Yeah, I mean, they're you know, chemistry is fine. But, you know, overall, I kept thinking, you know, I'd rather be watching The Heat again, frankly.
I would rather be watching a shorter version of The Heat. I feel like The Heat would have been great, but it just like really... It overextended itself. I felt The Heat was better as like a comedy than it was as a cop movie.
Mm-hmm.
The cop movie part just got way... forgotten.
Admittedly, but it's really not there to be a cop movie.
Yeah, I realize that, but if you're going to go through the motions, you should go through them well.
I guess.
And Two Guns really goes through the motions. It really tries to coast on charm, and there's a lot of charm in there. What I like about this movie is that it goes through a lot of scenes that we've seen before, and it does them in slightly different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a really fun bit where they're interrogating Edward James Olmos, and he's tied to a chair. And then the lights just go off, and then they go on again, and you see Mark Wahlberg waving his arms, and you realize you're in a garage with a motion sensor light, and it just keeps going on and off. And it's just like, they don't even comment on it. No one says, man, this is annoying. It's just this little detail.
No, admittedly, that was funny.
The world felt lived in. I liked a lot of the cast. It's an entertaining enough film, but I felt like if they had done a little bit more with the premise, which is really kind of a gold mine, they could have made it something more interesting. For example, if, you know, both of these guys are pretending to be criminals.
Right.
And when you introduce them, they're kind of broad criminal archetypes. Mark Wahlberg is this all bravado, ladies' man, kind of dork. And
you know what Wahlberg's character reminded me of? Mm. Wahlberg's character in Traveler.
Yeah, a little bit, actually. I can see that.
Which also featured Bill Paxton.
Indeed it did. And that's a pretty good movie. So he's got this broad character type. Denzel Washington is a bit more like, I've been around, I've seen everything, but I'm also like, I can get it for you, Eddie, you know, whatever.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
He's got like a trope. And then when I was like, okay, so they're neither of them are who they claim to be. Wouldn't it be great if their actual personalities were different and they, like, the reason why they don't get along or they don't trust each other is because they weren't being genuine? And then you found out that Mark Wahlberg was actually very respectful to women and this was all an act. Or Denzel Washington is in a little bit over his head and it feels like you could have done something that would have made a little bit more of a dramatic impact.
Right, no, but they just wanted to be like wacky buddy cops,
yeah,
and they're different.
They're exactly the same people once you find out who they are. And I was like, it would have been more interesting. And I feel like there's a lot of potential to have done something interesting. And instead, they made a pretty rogue caper comedy that only distinguishes itself by a few details that it does interestingly.
Yeah, so. I don't know. I just was underwhelmed. And also, I think, you know, poor Paula Patton. I'm sorry. I hope she got
paid. She deserves better than
this. Really well, because like one of the most sort of tacked-on nude scenes I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get into spoilers, but it bodes badly for things, you know?
Yeah.
And in a way that...
Which is another scene that doesn't go the way you'd normally expect it to go.
Decision.
No, I know, but the thing is, the way it's... Dave says that was her decision.
No, she said so on Chelsea Lately.
Okay, bully for her. She said so on Chelsea Lately. But what I'm saying is, the way the movie handles it is essentially as a way to punish the character. And with the implication being, if she were a good girl, you wouldn't have seen her breast, audience.
Okay, actually, I don't get the relationship to the nudity. I do get the relationship to if she were a good person, she wouldn't have ended up this way. But I actually don't see any. This movie isn't overtly negative towards women. It is strangely overtly negatory towards Mexicans, which is kind of odd.
Yeah, that was
like, I'll give you that, but like, I don't get like an attitude of cruelty towards women.
I'm gonna spoil it, and if you don't want to hear me to talk about how things turn out in Two Guns, skip ahead a bit.
All right.
So eventually we find out that Paula Patton's character is not trustworthy and that she's screwing over Denzel Washington.
Yeah,
and
she's the reason they're in trouble in the first place.
She's
gonna, she gets people killed.
She's going to try and steal them.
Yeah.
And so what I thought at the end was, of course, because if she hadn't been a villain, we wouldn't have seen her breasts. That's how Hollywood movies operate. You don't see the good girl's breasts, you see the bad girl's breasts, and shame on her for having them and showing them.
Give me like three other examples of that trope recently.
Oh, God.
No, I'm serious, because if this is a pattern, I'm not seeing it, and I want you to prove me wrong.
I don't know.
All
I'm saying is, think about it this way: that if a major, or not even a major, but a rising star actress is going to show her breasts in a movie. In this kind of movie, in a male action,
well, I'll give you
movie.
Flight. Flight, for example, is another one there. It doesn't bode well for the woman whose nudity opens the movie.
There you go.
Yeah. Maybe it's Denzel Washington's fault. Did you ever think about that?
Could be. I think that there's an unspoken sexism there, mm-hmm. where it's like, you know, only the only bad girls do, and that's why. You know.
So what you're really saying is we need more good girls to be naked in movies.
Yes.
Yes. Good. Okay. I'm with you on that. I think that we've kind of driven nudity and a lot of actual sexuality out of mainstream cinema.
Oh, no kidding.
Because
the
MPAA's fault, but I think it also has to do with the fact that the extreme easy accessibility of pornography has driven sexuality way back into the home. You don't take it out with you the way you used to, and it's a little uncomfortable for people sometimes
to experience something
erotic within a large group of people.
Audiences have voted with their feet when it comes to sex versus violence in movies, so it's not entirely the MPAA's
absolutely.
Fault.
Absolutely.
Circling back to the canyons, I was really, I have to say, I really enjoyed the fact that after the obligatory guy makes the two girls kiss sequence, we get the girls make the two guys kiss sequence.
Like, yeah. And it wasn't, and the character in the canyons, like Christian, he expressed discomfort with that later, but he did go for it at the time.
Yeah, in the moment.
It was actually pretty honest, and I do like the way that movie is kind of upfront about sexuality. There's a lot of nudity that isn't eroticized. It's just nudity.
Right.
They're walking around naked. Why? Because they're naked right now. They're
at home.
Yeah, right? Who gives a crap?
The canyons is unrated and mostly available on demand, and Two Guns is showing everywhere.
Yes, it's rated R, so bring the kids. There was this weird thing where they started making like big budget pornographic films, like The Pirates. I don't know if you remember that movie coming out. It was the biggest, most expensive pornographic film ever.
Oh, right,
made.
I remember.
And then they put
it
out an R-rated version,
right?
And they just cut out all the hardcore sexuality. And some comedian, I can't remember who I credit him, just said, "Fine." finally, porn I can watch with my kids. Like, that's not the point. I feel like if we were in a position to put more sexuality on camera mm-hmm. when it wasn't judged in some way, I think we'd all be a little bit better off. And a character who happens to be naked and then who does happen to turn out to be punished in some way for a moral transgression that had nothing to do with the sex scene wouldn't stand out so much, and it wouldn't feel so judgmental, because I didn't really pick up on that. But if that's the attitude that you're getting from a lot of movies lately, and maybe I'm seeing different movies, I guess that's kind of valid. I guess so.
You're right. It's all about what the overall context is, and because it's such a rarity in movies, I can't not read into it. Basically.
Thank you for admitting I'm right.
I'm just saying. I think we both have a point here.
We're both wrong.
There you go.
Okay.
Speaking of wrong, Smurfs 2.
Ah, the Smurfs 2. No, I didn't see the Smurfs 1.
What?
Did you see the Smurfs 1?
Oh, I saw the Smurfs 1.
I saw the trailer for the Smurfs 1. That was enough for me.
I didn't have a choice.
I did at the time. I would have if I had to. The Smurfs 2 takes place apparently a few years after this. Correct me if I'm wrong on anything.
Yes, yes.
Takes place a few years after the Smurfs 1.
Yes.
Gargamel, I guess, is trapped in the real world, which is weird because I thought the Smurfs were more or less in the real world just in the past to begin with.
Nope.
Fantasy world. Another reality.
Alternate dimension.
An alternate dimension. Gargamel, the incredibly offensive Jewish stereotype played by Hank Azaria, and always has been, and that's always been distracting to me. He's stuck in the real world, and he's a wizard, and he's using his magic to put on what looks like a really good magic show.
Mm.
Like, it looks like it's really fun. He's got, like, this, it looks like an evil kid show. He's got, like, I'm gonna walk out of my shack, and, like, with my cat who doesn't understand me, and I'm gonna turn people in the audience into giant frogs, and I'm like, that looks really cool. So he's really popular and successful and famous and rich, and he's still not happy.
He's running out of Smurf essence.
He's running out of Smurf essence, which I keep thinking of Dr. Strangelove every time they say that. It's purity of Smurf essence. And I'm like, so he needs more Smurf essence. So he kidnaps Smurfette, whom he created to infiltrate the Smurfs, and then she became indoctrinated into the Smurf cult. I'm sorry, I'm not making this sound very clear, because the movie is stupid. I'm sorry, it's really, the Smurfs weren't that great to begin with,
and
this is just infinitely more problematic.
I will say that Smurfs 2 is bad in a way that Smurfs 1 wasn't.
It looked like Smurfs 1 was like a commercial for everything that could afford to put their commercial in Smurfs 1.
Not that Smurfs 1 wasn't also bad, I just mean it's bad in a different way.
Yeah.
Smurfs 1 was sort of shrill and irritating.
Yeah.
It was the kind of movie that where no one was keeping Sofia Vergara in check. So
never a good
a
sign.
Lot of shrieking. Yeah. And then Smurfs 2 is sort of, it's irritatingly plotted. And then on top of it, this weird attempt to occasionally roughly shoehorn in these sort of adult-aimed jokes to kind of keep the parents awake.
I always hate that. If you're a good movie, you can have a consistent tone. You can have humor in a movie that appeals to kids and adults.
Absolutely.
Why the heck not?
Yeah, and you could even do it in a subtle way. Like, I mean, you mm-hmm. know, I didn't pick up on this until later, but for instance, in the upcoming Disney movie Planes, mm-hmm. There is a French-Canadian plane named Rochelle who is voiced by Julie Louis-Dreyfus.
Yes.
You remember the Rochelle joke from Seinfeld?
No.
I
didn't like Seinfeld.
Okay. Well, it was...
What was that, Dave?
Or The Sopranos.
I only saw the pilot episode of The Sopranos. I did watch a lot of Seinfeld, and while there's some brilliant episodes, I didn't particularly care for the tone of the show.
Well, anyway.
I never quite caught on with
it. So anyway, one of the joke movies in Seinfeld is a movie called Rochelle, A Young Girl's Erotic Journey from Somewhere to Minsk. I forget. Anyway.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, fair enough.
So yeah, so you can do stuff that goes over kids' heads and is still funny.
But
for adults,
there's a difference between going over kids' heads and just making a joke about testicles.
Testicles or Smurfholm syndrome, which wasn't funny for adults, and kids are going to be completely baffled.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not even one of those jokes where it's like you grow up and then you watch it again and they're like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah.
You'll just get, when you're an adult, you'll be like, well, that's just stupid.
That's still dumb.
Right. Well, you know, there's a thing... There's a philosophy with this kind of kids movie, or with like the Alvin and the Chipmunks kind of kids movies, uh-huh. where, you know, if it entertains kids, therefore, ergo, it must be okay.
Mm.
And that's a lie.
Oh, no.
That is a horrible, horrible... If anything entertains kids, then anything will entertain kids, and you might as well show them something good.
That's like saying, oh, well, my kid gets full on candy and white bread, so, you know,
therefore,
mission accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. Or we both made kind of a similar joke in our reviews, where were just like, you know, this movie will distract your kids for an hour and a half, and so will a cardboard box, and it's cheaper, and we'll make testicle jokes. And I said, you know, well, you know, kids might enjoy this movie, but think about how many kids who enjoy eating their own boogers. It's quite a few. That doesn't make it like something you should encourage. This movie is dumb. It's really cheap in a lot of ways. Like, they'll throw some money at CGI shots, but then they'll really mess one up. Like, there's one at the beginning where, like, Smurfette, who's, like, introduced in this really weirdly sexualized way, she's about to dive into a pool of water. Ooh, right. And then she comes out of the pool of water and she whips her hair, and her hair is completely dry. And instead of, you know, fixing that, because that's obviously a problem, there's, like, this one ADR joke that was clearly recorded at the last minute. It's like, hey, why is her hair dry? And I'm like, because they're stupid, because they screwed up. It's not you being funny calling attention to that. You just screwed up and made sure
well,
we noticed.
I noticed that moment, but I thought it was intentional.
I didn't think it was intentional. I don't give this movie enough credit for that. It's never clever enough to earn that.
But here's the thing. The movie is loaded with moments where it is apologizing for its own existence.
Yes, it is.
Whether there's a running gag of how irritating the little La La song is, or right. like, well, they'll tell a really dumb joke and then say, oh yes, I said it, or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't make it any funnier.
Yeah,
you know?
it's the Mike Myers school of comedy. That's what got old with him real fast. Is he couldn't just make a joke. He always had to like sort of look at you and go, "Yeah, that was sorry about that."
Yeah, we're not all Jack Benny.
And the other thing that's weird about this movie is every once in a while you see like a kids movie, and a lot of kids movies have sort of a moral agenda, and oftentimes they're really supportable. You know, like protect the environment or be
follow
nice to each
dreams.
Other, follow your dreams. I mean, it's a cliche, but no. Whatever. It's not a terrible message.
Sure.
And every once in a while you see one that's oddly specific, and you get the idea that someone on the production is making this to like show their own kids.
Oh.
And like in this one, it's
step parents are nice.
This one is all step parents are great because they choose to be your parents.
Right.
And your original parents, if they're jerks, can just be thrown aside. And I'm like, there's a lot of context that's kind of missing there, and that's not going to apply to every kid.
Yeah.
And I got the impression that there's some producer somewhere who made the Smurfs who's like having trouble with like his new stepson.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, can we just shoehorn this in there? But what it does lead to is the only really good thing in the Smurfs 2, which is Brendan Gleeson, who's not in like any of the marketing materials because I guess kids don't care who Brendan Gleeson
no.
is. Mm-hmm. But like I remember seeing I was watching the credits, like Brendan Gleeson is in this.
Yeah,
is he, like a weird
was
voice.
Like, are you kidding?
And
me?
Then he's in it a lot, and he's live action. He plays Neil Patrick Harris's stepdad,
right.
who can't catch a break. And then he turns into a duck, and that's like the best part of the movie.
But
and
see,
that's like,
I knew that when even Brendan Gleeson as a duck wasn't making me laugh, that
yeah.
I was doomed.
It's still like, you know, it's interesting though, because as disingenuous as this whole type of movie can be, any sort of genuineness that this movie had to it was brought by Brendan Gleeson. And I just want to give you, he deserves a little bit of credit for overachieving in such a turd. Like,
sure.
it's There's a moment where he just talks to Neil Patrick Harris, and he talks about, like, you know, I give up. I've been trying, you know, for many years to be your dad, and you just won't let me in. And it's just, and it's actually, like, it's like, did he see the title of the movie? Like, did he not know? Like, did they film this stuff without telling him it's a Smurfs movie? It's just weird, and I just picture him, like, on a sailboat right now going, ha-ha, got away with it. I don't know.
No, he's fine, but yeah, he can't save the thing. You know, I did kind of like the flying through the eaves of Notre Dame on storks sequence, but I think that any,
in the abstract, yeah.
any 3D movie is immediately improved with a flying sequence. You know,
I guess.
Look, I'm not
I
saying
really
go
care.
See the movie for this. I'm just saying it was at least one moment where I thought, okay, well, there's some effort was involved in this, even if this is entirely fake because they shot the whole movie in Montreal. you know,
yeah.
There's
yeah.
a little something going on here. Anyway,
it's not
yeah.
enough to recommend this movie
oh,
in any
God,
way,
no.
shape,
no.
or form. And when I say Brendan Gleeson's good, I just mean like, you know, if you're forced to see this movie for whatever reason, because you're babysitting or something like that, just keep your eyes on Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah.
He'll get you through it.
There was some review that talked about like the wide-eyed panic of Jemma Mays, that she just looked like she was terrified the entire movie.
Get me out of this. I can't believe I signed that contract. What was I thinking? I'm on Glee.
Well, she was in the first one, so
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, no, but like she signed a contract to be in the second
right,
one.
Right,
like
exactly.
That's a movie you make when you don't know if you're going to have a career.
Right.
And like, I'll take it, and then I'll pay my rent this year or something. What else? What is next?
Next is The Spectacular Now.
Love it.
Yeah.
Great movie.
I really liked a lot, and I didn't know until later that it was directed by the guy who did Smashed.
Which I haven't seen.
Because this is a way, way smarter movie about a similar subject matter, namely alcoholism.
Booze.
Yeah, so it stars Miles Teller from Rabbit Hole and Footloose and
yeah.
21 and Over, and Shailene Woodley from The Descendants, and he is a sort of breezy high school senior, like,
yeah.
you know... popular and, you know, thinks
popular,
he's...
Popular, but not the popular kid. Just, no one has a problem with this guy. Everyone right. seems to think he's cool.
Everyone is amused by this guy. As it goes along, you sort of find out that maybe a lot more people think he's a joke than he realizes.
Yeah, they're amused by him, but no one takes him seriously.
No, no,
yeah.
not at all. And so after breaking up with his girlfriend, he winds
up... She breaks up with him.
Yeah, after getting dumped by his girlfriend. Yeah. He winds up falling for Shailene Woodley's character, who mm-hmm. is... You know, quiet and kind of a nerd and smart and mm-hmm. studious, and, you know, she reads
a calming manga. Influence.
Yeah, but, you know, yeah. but she's not like sort of movie nerd girl with like big thick glasses or, you know, yeah. chopsticks in her hair.
Nor is she manic pixie dream girl, which I think we're done with yeah. as a culture. No. She feels very real. She's very comfortable with herself. But she's also, and it's interesting because I really like the way that both of these characters, because there's not much plot to it. They just sort of fall for each other. He deals with some of his unresolved issues. She deals with some of her unresolved issues, and together they grow, sometimes apart, sometimes together. And that's the movie, really. Yeah. There's not a heist or anything in it. It's just a good coming of age story. It is enough. It is enough when you have characters that are this well written, this wonderfully acted, and you just believe it. And but what I like about it is that they sort of change each other for the better and the worse. He helps her become a little bit more confident and outgoing, and sort of enjoy her youth a bit right. more than she was, because she was helping her mom. She was basically doing her mom's day job for her in addition yeah. to going to high school. And
he also gives her her first flask.
Yes, and she and here's the thing. So he is a functioning alcoholic.
Yeah.
We discover over the course of the film he's always got this big gulp, and it's not like a late reveal, but you start to, it's not like I'm an alcoholic. It's like every once in a while you just see him fill it with booze, and yeah, you start realizing you see that all the time.
The word alcoholic is never uttered in this film, which is one of the things I really like about
it. But it is acknowledged that he does have a very distinct problem.
Definitely.
And he does transfer that a little bit to her. And it manages to tell a story, bless you, about teen drinking mm-hmm. without turning it into an after-school special.
No, not in the slightest.
It treats the issue very honestly and with a lot of sympathy and understanding, and it never feels judgmental. Mm. And that is so refreshing, because the thing I think people forget about like teen movies and kids movies, like The Smurfs and Spectacular Now, on mm. very different levels, but like yes. they're catered towards a different demographic.
Where's this going?
They're catered towards young demographics. They're made by old people. They're made by people who are adults and looking back.
Sure.
And oftentimes it's too easy to pander, and it's too easy to judge, because you're not at that point in your life anymore. And this feels really honest. This feels like, even if this wasn't your personal experience, there's bound to be something Spectacular Now, I think, that will relate to you in some way, you'll sympathize with.
I was calling it a teenager under the influence. Because it's very, you know, there's not histrionic, and it's not... it doesn't hard sell any of what it's trying to do, neither the relationship nor his drinking or just the character traits in general. They feel very believable and lived in.
Yeah.
And you know, I like the fact that it's almost sort of an onion that we unravel as we get to know this guy more and more, and we realize how much of his bravado is just a facade, and how you know, I love the scene where, you know, he works in this men's store in town that's owned by Bob Odenkirk, and Odenkirk basically sits him down and says, like, look, I can only have one, you know, one extra person working here. I would like it to be you, but I need you to, you know, not be late, not show up drunk, da da da. And he basically says, I can't do that. And it's such a, you know, I can't remember a scene I've seen like it, where it's basically somebody sort of, in a very low-key way, owning up to his own faults and mm-hmm. and at a you know, crisis point in his life, basically, like, either mm-hmm. I get my act together and keep this job, or I just keep doing what I'm doing and go down the, you know, down the rabbit, or down the sewer, basically, and he chooses B, you know.
It's interesting to me that so much of the critical discourse surrounding this movie is about what it's not. Have you noticed that? I feel like the teen genre has gotten so rigidly defined lately that it feels like you can't tell a story about teenagers, with a few notable exceptions like Perks of Being a Wallflower, without artifice. Like, it always has to be told through a genre veil. It always has to be like, you know, it's about, you know, this sort of cutthroat tale of growing up, so naturally it's in a dystopic future and we all fight to the death. And here's one that just feels very natural and very sweet, and it does. It's not loaded down with false incident. Well, it's just human.
It's funny. I there was a discussion going on a friend's Facebook page where he was talking about how much he liked this movie, and somebody else was like, "Oh, it's, you know, it's really unfair to call it a coming of age film. It's so much richer, blah blah." And I thought to myself, "No, it's a coming of age film.
It's exactly what
you
it's about.
you just think of a coming of age film as being something you don't like, or that is going to offer is going to feature certain aspects that you don't like, and so you don't want to put this movie in that category."
No, I'm going to say right now, this is
it's a coming of age.
This is a story about a very simple transition from a certain degree of immaturity to a certain degree of maturity that takes place during the transition from legal child to legal adult.
Right.
That's a coming-of-age story, no matter how you slice it.
Yeah.
It's a really good one, and I think it's one of the best we've had in a while, because, like, we don't make this kind of, like, sensitive drama about young people the way we used to.
I mean, I think this has been a good year for this kind of movie. I liked The Way Way Back quite a bit.
I missed that one. I heard that
Was you know, it's much more comedic than this one is, but I think it scores in a lot of the same ways. And while it's a much more glib movie, I thought The Kings of Summer was entertaining as well.
The Kings of Summer drove me nuts, actually. I wanted to like it. There's a lot of charm to it. The concept is funny. A lot of the actors are funny.
I remember you talking about this on your show now. Yeah,
it just drives me nuts. There's this sort of, it exists in a universe of weird problems that I couldn't quite relate to and wrap my head around. And it wants to be a broad comedy, and it wants to be taken seriously, and it doesn't get the balance right for me. But it's worth seeing. I did end up recommending it.
I mean,
it never achieves greatness.
Sitcom one-linery occasionally, but I still was into it. But
I still dig it. It's an okay movie.
Spectacular Now is opening limited this weekend and expanding. So
definitely
seek it out.
Seek it out wherever you can find it.
And then Passion.
Brian De Palma's Passion, his first movie in quite a few years. Was
it
Redacted?
Redacted,
which I missed Redacted, but I'm actually a huge De Palma fan, and I've seen most of his movies.
This is currently available on demand. It's having a theatrical release at the end of the month. But
you living over there, Dave? You making out okay?
Yeah.
All right, it's gonna be in theaters in late August. Yeah. I forget if it's the 23rd or the 30th.
It's already available on demand, I guess, to a larger audience than it will ever be available to theatrically, so we're just gonna
probably. So I do feel like if you're gonna see this movie, it's well constructed enough visually, like indeed most Brian De Palma movies, to be worth seeing on the big screen.
I feel like
my computer did this movie a bit of a disservice, at least visually.
Yeah, I watched it on TV. I bought it off of Amazon. I mean, yes, De Palma is a visual stylist, and every visual style you've ever liked from Brian De Palma makes a cameo appearance in this film.
It certainly does.
It's almost like that's entertainment of De Palma movies. It's all...
that makes Passion sound more fun than it is.
Yeah, no, it's not. I found it kind of ludicrous, but I just was sort of amused by, oh, look, split screen, and oh, look, the all these things that he's done before. I mean, a lot of them. It gets kind of ridiculous.
Well, it feels like he's repeating a lot of his own material here. The Passion is... stars Nomi Rapace from the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Rachel McAdams from Rachel McAdams movies.
And it's a remake of a French film from a couple years ago called Love Crime.
Which I had not seen. Have you seen that?
I have not, no. Okay. Christian Scott Thomas and Ludivine Sonia is an Alain Cabot film.
And basically, they're both businesswomen. Rachel McAdams is Nomi Rapace's boss. They work in an advertising agency. It's kind of a cutthroat world.
I put in quotes, Europe. Like, were you ever clear where they were?
I think it's supposed to be Germany.
I couldn't tell, but I thought they were in France, and then I thought they were in Germany, and maybe they were in Switzerland.
You're right. I don't know why you did air quotes. No one can see you do that. He did air quotes around Europe.
Yeah, that's why I said I'm doing air quotes.
Okay, that's air quote inflection. Yes. Is that what that is?
Right.
Okay.
Or as Kathy Griffin has said, Europia.
Yes. And in any case, so it's kind of this cutthroat world. Rachel McAdams is screwing Nomi Rapace over at work, but Nomi Rapace is sleeping with Rachel McAdams' boyfriend. There's a lot of like... It's actually no sexual chemistry, but there's a lot of attempt at sort of sexual interplay between them.
Yeah, they want to create this sort of... It starts out giggly, and then later it gets more serious, but he's trying to sort of do some sort of fakey lesbian-y stuff that never really quite sticks with them.
No, and... but I bought that it wasn't supposed to stick. I bought that a lot of that was sort of like people trying to manipulate each other by using sort of a sexual interaction to make someone uncomfortable or potentially make someone more dependent on you or at least more sympathetic. And so it all comes to a head. They start hating each other more and more and more. And then I don't want to ruin the second half because that's where all the good stuff is.
Sure,
but
like
someone dies.
Yeah.
And so someone gets accused of it. And then it becomes... It's interesting because that's so much of the first half of the movie. It's actually a pretty staid, very dry kind of movie. And that's not usually, I think, what De Palma does best. De Palma does sort of exuberance and passion.
Crazy Town.
And Crazy Town. And he's really good at Crazy Town. And
a lot of this movie just feels kind of flat for a while, and then he suddenly, it's like he all of a sudden got interested in the movie with like this really interesting split screen sequence, which I totally dug, with like putting a murder on one side and then a ballet on the other, which is contrived, but it was interesting, and he filmed it in an interesting way where the ballerina is always looking directly at the camera,
right.
So it's always sort of distracting you from something that from the plot is more interesting on the other side. Right side is always dark, left side is always white.
So here's the thing,
and it's a big misdirect as well, and I thought that was actually kind of clever. It just doesn't really have anything to do with anything.
Okay, when all is said and done and all is explained, like torturously, lengthily explained.
Indeed.
Did any of it feel all that surprising to you, or were you
none
of
it.
Course?
No. None of it felt surprising.
Yeah, that was my problem.
None of it was a surprise. I think there's some really excellent cinematography in the second half, in particular. I think Brian De Palma knows how to shoot a movie.
Mm-hmm.
He made a choice that I don't think did the movie a lot of favors in the beginning, to keep it very static, because I just couldn't get as into it as I would have liked. But once the second half of the movie comes in, I do think it's just he's good at that, and I think it is. If you're a fan of his stuff, it's probably worth watching. But this is lesser De Palma,
much.
Which is in the way of saying that, like, do you like Hitchcock? It's lesser Argento. It's just sort of like, he's having a little bit of fun here. There's clearly a few scenes that he likes more than others. Ultimately, this feels disposable within his oeuvre.
The critics use this joke a lot. This is the kind of movie that De Palma could make in his sleep, and apparently he did.
I was
never really drawn into it. It all just felt like such a rehash, and not even.
It almost feels like he's trying to grow up, but he doesn't. He's not interested in that.
No, I don't think so.
I feel like the first half of it is he's trying to be like sort of slick and stylish and pull back and a little bit more European, not Italian, but European.
But even then, he was doing there's so many two shots of, blonde Rachel McAdams wearing like a cream or maybe a pink outfit, and Noomi Rapace, brunette, and
Alonzo,
a black
you
outfit.
Don't get it. They're two sides of the same coin, man.
Is that what I mean?
There's a dichotomy here. He's splitting the screen.
It's the 18 times that they did that shot, I didn't quite get it. So thank you, Brian De Palma.
It feels like this is another movie that would have been a lot better if it was a lot shorter. I'm not sure what the running time is, but it feels like if this was like an 88-minute movie and you could have just condensed it, this would have had a lot more momentum.
Everything would be better, shorter.
Well, generally speaking, but this one feels like there's a lot of padding that's unnecessary. And I do like this, though. I do think that he could have turned Rachel McAdams' character, and I don't know what about the movie it's based on and how that character was treated before, but you could have turned Rachel McAdams' character into a very simplistic, evil, femme fatale ice queen. And I do think he does sort of interesting things with the way Noomi Rapace responds to her and invades her personal privacy. And, like, the few times you see her alone and you see how, like, sort of a bit more of an interesting and vulnerable person who's evil for a reason. I kind of like that. I thought that was refreshing. I think
you're giving it a lot of credit. I think
it's in there. I don't think it's in service of anything. I'm just saying I'm looking for things to enjoy here, because I do love I love Brian De Palma movies, sure. More or less. Even kind of crap ones like Snake Eyes. Like, Snake Eyes is fun.
This reminded me of Raising Kane.
I love Raising Kane.
See, I know De Palma purists love Raising Kane because it's sort of his sort of doing his thing. And I think this movie is the same thing, where it drove me up the wall because I just felt like you're just doing your thing again.
As someone who loves Raising Kane and who is in this lobbed in this group that you just made up, would just say Passion is no Raising Kane.
Okay, well.
Passion is no Raising Kane. No, this is not a good De Palma movie.
No, by the end of the movie, I was laughing out loud at some of the twists that he was trying to unpack at the very end. And also, did you ever get the impression that, like, they're both working this advertising firm, and there's this whole smartphone account they're trying to land and coming up with a new provocative ad campaign for it? Did you get the impression that De Palma had never used a cell phone until six months ago?
Yeah, I definitely got that impression. Yeah.
There's something about it.
The entire business that they work at, it feels like no one did any research into it. Yeah. And it just feels like, here are the business files you asked for. Oh, no, all of our business is going bad. I hear he's stealing from my business. Like, there's no implicit understanding that anyone knows how to do their job, knows how to advertise.
No.
The fake commercial they come up with
is awful.
It's kind of awful. Like, there's like almost a cute idea in there, but why is it 3 minutes long? Like, that's stupid.
Well, I was telling Dave this. It's also one of those movies where there are certain movies you feel like, okay, I want to shoot in Paris, or I want to shoot in Rome or something. And there's other movies like, well, all my financiers are in Europe, so I got to shoot in Europe, but I'm going to maybe sort of try and...
This definitely feels like the loud... You get no local flavor from it. There's no reason why you couldn't have shot this in Montreal or Los Angeles or Houston. There's no reason.
Yeah.
It's just... And it ends up... And it's weird because like almost all the characters are American or at the very least English speaking, like fluent English speaking.
Right, right, right.
And like there's really no reason why you couldn't have even just pretended it was America. You would have gotten away with it. It would have been fine.
And there's a plot twist that relies not only on a character popping pills, but on a character throwing pills around like they're confetti.
And it's like, and it's weird because that's, remember Side Effects?
Yes.
A similar, did you see Side Effects?
I did, but
there's a similar like sort of plot point where it's like, here's this character and she's popping pills and everyone sees her popping pills and that mm-hmm. is a plot point. And Side Effects has it a lot better. And right. Side Effects has a reason to
because
exist.
Because in Side Effects, she's not basically jamming those pills into somebody else's face. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's,
No. And Side Effects is like the good version of passion, I think.
Oh, no question. And, yeah. And I mean, somebody told me that Love Crimes is more sort of like, almost sort of a corporate All About Eve, whereas De Palma is making it more De Palma-y.
But yeah, I think that approach would have worked. I think there would have been more right. happening in the movie. It would have, the focus would have been on something a little bit more zippy and not just I'm depressed. I think I'll kill someone. Maybe I'm not a lesbian. Whatever.
It's this was a hot mess, and I would. Yeah. I mean,
I find things to like in this movie, but yeah, it's not a good movie.
I don't adore De Palma, but I like him enough that I want to see him get.
What is your favorite De Palma?
Better gigs. My favorite De Palma? Well, Carrie, I guess.
All right, what's your favorite non-cliché De Palma?
Casualties of War.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Mine's Body Double. I think Body Double is kind of a wonderful display cornucopia of craziness.
I haven't seen Body Double, and okay. I haven't seen Dressed to Kill.
I also love Untouchables, even though that's kind of one of the sellout
movies.
I like
Untouchables, yeah.
Kicks it.
And even Mission Impossible, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, Body Double and Dressed to Kill are both in my I'm waiting to see them on the big screen category.
Oh, that
and they do turn up here.
They'll do you wonders to see those on the big screen. They're wonderful.
I need to see
them. Yeah.
So actually, my DVD pick this week is Femme Fatale.
Oh, see, I didn't care for Femme Fatale.
Oh, I loved Femme Fatale.
Oh, wow, see, you're a weird Brian De Palma
2002
fan.
Brian De Palma. Okay. Here's a movie where he gets lesbians right, and where there's a plot twist that you genuinely will not see coming, and when they put it all together at the end of the film, it's fascinating and fun to watch as opposed to Passion, where they put it all together and you're like, well, yeah, duh, obviously.
Maybe I need to see this movie again, because when it all came crashing together, then I felt gypped. I felt like I felt screwed. I don't like this.
Even if it doesn't
I don't remember.
It's been a while since I've seen it. I don't remember if it made any logical sense, but I went with it anyway by that point. I don't know. I had a good time.
It is the last movie of Brian De Palma's that I can remember where he really felt like he was energized. Like he really felt like he was really involved and like loved what he was doing, even if it was mad.
Right.
And I do love that.
And it had Rebecca Romijn.
Looking fabulous.
Yes.
Do I get a DVD pick?
Please, yes.
Okay. It has nothing to do with anything we talked about. It's just new, and I think it's the first time it's out on Blu-ray. Uh-huh. I want you to see it. It's called The Boy and His Dog.
Oh, yes.
A wonderful sci-fi movie directed by L.Q. Jones, character actor who, I guess younger audiences probably know him from Mask of Zorro. He played Three-Finger Jake, but he was in a lot of Westerns. Don Siegel's Hell is for Heroes. He's a great, great actor. Yeah. And he only directed a couple of movies. And this one stars Don Johnson as this like young kid and it's a late 70s movie. It's a young kid in
early
a
70s.
Is it early 70s? Mid 70s, whatever. It's based on a Harlan Ellison story. It takes place in a post-apocalyptic.
Did Ellison write the screenplay or no?
I think L.P. Jones wrote the screenplay.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Ellison might have helped. I don't remember. But it takes place, it's post-apocalyptic wasteland, and this was kind of before that was a cliche, too.
Right.
Like, it was one of the forefront.
Pre-Mad Max.
It is pre-Mad Max. And it looks like Mad Max, too, so I wonder if George Miller saw it. Don Johnson is in the post-apocalyptic wasteland, he's trying to survive. His only companion is a dog, and due to, like, radiation or whatever, the dog is psychic. Mm-hmm. So it is, like, a story about a boy and his dog, and it's so adorable, and they kill people, and he's just desperate to have sex with anyone because it's hard to in the future because a lot of men survive and women didn't. And I actually don't want to ruin this movie for you because a lot of it's just this sort of interesting existential kind of sci-fi action movie, and then it takes a very weird turn in the second half when he encounters like a civilization of people that's trying to put society back together, but they're doing it in a way that's just like, what?
Yeah.
How many episodes of The Prisoner did you watch? Because this is weird. But it's definitely worth a look. It was hard to find for a really long time.
Right.
So it comes out on DVD on, I think, August 6th.
Yes.
Sorry, on Blu-ray, August 6th. So check it out. It's really, really good. And
yes, I endorse this. It's a cool movie. Fun fact, the dog also played Tiger on the Brady Bunch.
No kidding.
Yep, same dog.
Wow, that was like that dog's angel heart.
Yeah, the leaf for Lisa Bonet.
The Brady Bunch is just like, we don't know what happened to you, man. We thought you were cool. You need to get your butt to church.
Okay, so now I'm going to bring Dave White back because we have the very first ever linoleum knife giveaway. It's so exciting. You won't even believe it.
I'm gonna hand the mic over to Dave White now. Ladies and gentlemen, the sultry and luminous Dave White.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, you didn't hear me right when I was talking. I met Rebecca Romijn.
Oh, closer to the mic, please.
I met Rebecca Romijn.
Oh. Was she nice?
At a party.
Uh-huh.
Like 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
Oh.
Yeah. She's tall.
What'd you talk about?
She's real nice. No, I just said, hey, good to meet you. And then I went to the food table.
Good old name-dropping Dave White.
She was at a party. I was there too. Big fancy Hollywood party with celebrities.
You could have mentioned that we're bros with Gary Cotti, who was her AD on the short-lived Eastwick TV
whatever
show
that was. Yeah,
the Wishes of Eastwick series that died quickly.
Yeah,
I just want people to know that I'm pretty glamorous.
That's right.
I was at a Hollywood party
with L.A. Dave
celebrities.
L.A. Joan.
She was there with her husband.
Jerry O'Connell?
Mr. Romijn. He's nice, too.
That's good.
Also tall.
Fat Jerry O'Connell or skinny Jerry O'Connell?
Fat.
Yeah, I think.
Mm. Oh, for my personal preference?
Yeah.
Skinny Jerry O'Connell.
Okay, fine.
I like
straight guy.
Well, no. I didn't realize that was...
What is that?
I don't know.
I was a sliders. I liked sliders. What do you want?
Most people will vote for skinny Jerry O'Connell. I'm just giving you a hard time. Anyway, so Dave White, giveaway. Explain, please.
So we got sent this doll. The Conjuring doll showed up on our front doorstep.
If you've seen The Conjuring, you'll recall the horrifying doll that appears throughout.
The creepy, gross doll we got with sent the mustache under its lip.
Yeah, we got sent a smaller version, but still creepy.
It's about a foot tall. It's about, you know...
If you were a student nurse, it will run roughshod over you in your sleep. You know,
it's a standard-sized little dolly of death. It's the kind of doll that if you actually own this doll and the demon comes to your house, you're sort of like, well, I deserved
that. Yeah, you brought it on yourself.
Like the doll, obviously, I'm the kind of person that owns this sort of thing.
Yeah.
I deserve to have
it. What do people need to do in order to get this
doll? You can have it, you see, because we can't sell it because it's swag and
it needs to get out of this house.
And it needs to get out of this house before we get demoned.
Yeah.
So it's also got a little tag on it that says miss me like it did in the movie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's gross. Alonzo will take a picture of it.
Yes.
So it's this thing from The Conjuring. It's still in the box. We haven't taken it out. We're going to give it away to a listener.
And how's that going to work, Dave White?
It's an essay writing contest.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we're making you work for it.
Oh, God. How many words? Single spaced, double spaced?
50 words or less.
That's not really an essay.
It's an anecdote contest.
A sentence writing contest. Right. Why you deserve to have this doll. Be smart. Spell things right. You don't spell things right, you're disqualified. Do some grammars.
Yeah.
Or you're disqualified.
Yeah, you say Y-O-U-R when you mean Y-O-U apostrophe R-E.
We will use your essay to wipe our butts, mm-hmm. even though it's going to be an email.
We'll print it out.
We'll print it out.
On 2-ply.
And we'll wipe our butts with it.
And each of us with the same one, too. It's going to be like a real weird party.
So
don't judge our intimacy.
I'm not judging. I'm just revealing.
Yeah. So, that's it.
Okay. And where should they send that, Dave White?
Wait a second. Hold on. Hang on. Don't tell me.
2.5 years.
Linoleum Podcast.
Linoleum Cast?
Linoleum Podcast.
Linoleum Podcast.
It is a podcast.
Gmail.com.
Okay. Correct. Linoleum Podcast.
Linoleum Podcast. Boom. @gmail.com. Why do you deserve the doll from The Conjuring? And actually, you know, that sounds like it should be bad. Like, you know, oh, God, I deserve that. What have I done to deserve this?
What have you done to deserve sin could a man commit in a single lifetime?
You amazing colossal man.
Bibbs, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank
you for having me.
Remind everyone where they can find you.
You can find me, you can find all my writing, at, or 99% of my writing, at craveonline.com at the Film Channel, where I am the editor and lead critic. You can listen to me every week on the B Movies podcast. If you're in Los Angeles, you can actually still hear me at Friday mornings at 9:45 a.m. At KFWB 980, where they let me do movie reviews despite my many failings. you can follow me on Twitter at William Bibbiani, WILLIAMBIBBIANI.
All right.
And I'll see you on the internet.
And we'll put links to Bibbs's Twitter account on our Facebook page. As always, we ask you to check out we thank you for listening, and we remind you to check out our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast.
Yay!
Film Spotting, SVU, Pod Crash, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at iTunes, and if you want to leave us a positive review there, that would be nifty. You can stream us at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com. Like our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. Check into the show at GetGlue.com. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with your questions, your comments, your top 10 list, your bottom 10 list, and your essays on why you deserve the Conjuring doll. Thank you to the people who resent your emails that we hadn't gotten to yet, because Dave still doesn't know how to keep track of all the emails, but we now have them again, and we will get them read by gum on a future episode when Dave's voice is back. Were you adding something, or you're just going to go...
Goodbye.